Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We're bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays, 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Mondays at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com, and archiving the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. We encourage you to check out our guests' website. We link to them on both the schedules page, and then when they've aired, the broadcast has aired, we then shift over to the radio shows page. And you can click on that link and find out all about our guests, including our guest who makes a return visit and also a visit to Santa Barbara. And in studio today is Richard House, MD. His book, Between Now and When. Welcome to the studio, to Tell Me Your Story, to Santa Barbara. Thank you so much for, so to speak, taking me up on my invitation.
It's a pleasure to be here, Richard.
This is great. I've always enjoyed these face-to-face interviews. You actually have something I used to have. You also have something I hope to have one day. What I hope to have one day is my book finished. I'm still working on it. It's going on, what would we say, in 2016, going on 15 years.
Wow.
It's not that big of a book. It's like, what is my problem? And you have a ponytail, which I used to have. And I still actually, technically, I do have it. It's bound up in a box. when I cut my hair for my wife's, in solidarity of my wife's going through chemotherapy in 2001, I wanted to keep it. And so the guy, he sprayed it real good with the sort of hairspray or whatever it was, made sure it was bound up, and then he cut it off, and then took off the rest. And I've kept it that way ever since. And it works, and I enjoy it. And it was interesting. It was sort of my diving into, what do I want to say, the my rebellious phase. Mm-hmm. I mean, people would look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you are a few years older than I, probably not much. And yet you are still in, because of the ponytail, what some might say, oh, you're still in that rebellious phase. And yet you are also there with what I would consider to be a very compassionate and understanding perspective towards people and what they're going through. The issues that they're dealing with on a physical, mental, and emotional level, as well as spiritual. And I find this fascinating, especially when taking a look at, of course, your book, Between Here and Now. Between Now and When. Here and Now, Now and When. And by the way, the website, before we go too much further, is richardhousemd.com. That's richardhousemd.com. And, of course, we will be linked to you. Matter of fact, we're linked with the first interview to your website, so people can go there and find out more about you. You've traveled all the way here to Santa Barbara. From where?
North Carolina.
Wow.
A small town, Goldsboro. I live out in the country, on acreage, have bees, goats, that kind of thing.
And obviously it agrees with you.
So far it does, yeah. You know, as we get older, these things are a little more difficult. But, yeah, I'm real happy living. It's the way I stay grounded. As you say, I spend my days seeing folks in the office, doing energy work with them, mainly through the chakra system. Mm-hmm. And I sort of enter the chakra system through acupuncture theory and the acupuncture meridians. But as you have said, I work with people's problems all mm-hmm. day. And so I come home and get my feet on the ground, pull some weeds and plant things and that kind of thing.
I've heard it said that living in a situation such as yourself, or myself for that matter, because I live up on the hill above Santa Barbara, as I call it, it's a rural area. We're on a septic system, for example. We have a well where we get our water. We have a little gray water system for the wash, you know, wash water and so forth. We try to make our space as sustainable as possible. Used to have some chickens. We have dogs, cats, so forth. Love it up there. We have a certain element of seclusion and isolation. You really have to know where you're going to find us, which is kind of nice. But then again, I have to play FAA. Ground control sometimes when bringing people in. And it's just, they say, I've heard it said by many of our guests, that when you connect with nature in that way, or even if you're living in the urban areas and you have a front yard or a backyard and you can get your hands in the dirt, not only metaphorically but literally, there's something about that that sort of, I don't know, centers you, re-energizes you, and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences in that regard?
Yes. As you say, the grounding part is important, but physicality is something that is a commonality between all of us. But those of us who do energy work, spiritual work, are dealing with higher dimensional spheres. And so one of the ways that we can not only keep ourselves grounded, but to also recognize the oneness in everyone is being very intimately involved with physicality. The tendency as we grow spiritually is to have our heads up in the clouds, and if our feet are up there, boy, nothing gets done.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this world here that we deal with where we have to pay bills, where the IRS is hounding us, you know, these kinds of things.
Death and taxes, as they say.
Death and taxes, yeah. Yeah. We have to interact with people on that level, too. And so I think that's why people like you, like I, like a lot of people, find that they can't do their work unless they're doing that grub in the dirt kind of stuff, too.
And I remember hearing some statistics in regards to the health and well-being of adults who, as children, literally played in the dirt. And I'm one of those. They had fewer diseases because the dirt provided a lot of the, I don't want to say antibodies, but a lot of the stuff that our bodies could use to build the immune system as we grew up. And in one sense, you know, you've heard the, you know, a mother or father's telling their child who's out there eating dirt, don't eat dirt. Well, you probably don't really want to, but as long as, you know, it's not toxic, it's not going to kill you. And it actually may be beneficial. I mean, it's like everything is here for us to sustain our lives. There's nothing that's missing, you know. And I think that's one of the things that I think we're slowly, and unfortunately very slowly, we're beginning to understand is that we've had everything that we've ever needed to maintain and sustain our lives right here on the planet. And we don't have to take other things on the planet and manufacture and sift and strain and separate and so forth. It's all right there as is.
So that's exactly right. And when you think about antibiotics, for instance, something that we're using more and more, going back to the business of eating dirt, what that does is it puts new organisms in our biome. You may not be familiar with that term, but biome is the new word for the complicated colonization of our colons, of all things. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research going on in that. In fact, there's some indications that autism is caused by imbalance in the bacteria and viruses that inhabit the colon.
Hmm.
So actually, our kids would be far better to eat dirt than to get an antibiotic for an ear infection, because the antibiotics not only destroy the pathogens, but they're also interfering with the culture that grows naturally in the colon. And a lot of people don't know this, but the immune system cells, a large number of them, are manufactured in the colon, of all places. To the extent now there's research all over the world going on, and in some cases they're actually doing, get ready for this, fecal transplants, where people that have disturbed digestion, mainly chronic colitis and so on, are getting great benefit from having a restoration of their colonic bacteria by healthy samples of stool. That's pretty crazy, isn't it?
Well, I suppose in one sense it is, but I mean, if you think about it, a blood transfusion is kind of the same idea, if you will, of taking someone else's healthy blood and pumping it into your veins. And in this case, though it may seem rather unappetizing and, you know, rather to some rather gross or disgusting, the reality is that, again, we have everything we need. And it's right there if we would just look. I sometimes wonder, and I don't know about you, when I hear about a lot of these medical innovations, new scientific breakthroughs, especially in gene therapy and DNA sequencing and all these kinds of things to try to sort of modify the human race. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but I've always asked the question, just because we can, does that mean we should? Because we don't know what Pandora's box we're opening. What are we opening ourselves up to? It's like you were talking about antibiotics. Now, I've never cared for this particular analogy, but I think it's appropriate. It was used when someone was talking about our immune systems. And it was said that your immune system is kind of like a military force. And if it's never challenged and tested, it will never strengthen. And that's what it's there for. Now, I myself, from as of our conversation here, I just went through a bout of food poisoning. Now, I didn't take anything for it. I just let it run its course. I lost 8 pounds in the process, which that didn't bother me in the least. It was uncomfortable for a day and a half or so. And then as I began to get my strength back, you know, I was feeling good. And I thought, okay, my system took care of it. I didn't take anything for it. Obviously, if it had gotten worse, I would have certainly gone to the ER and that kind of thing. But let's talk a little bit about that in terms of that most important, I think, of attributes to our physiology, and that's our immune system. That system that helps to not only ward off, but keep us alive and going and thriving, hopefully.
Absolutely. And there's so many ways to address that with without using drugs. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for a person to reach our age and never take any medication. But you got to do something because our world is toxic. So how do we do that? Well, one of the ways is through acupuncture. Chiropractic, too, is quite valuable. Of course, Western medicine is kind of looked down their nose at these things and considered to be quackery. But I'm here to tell you, I've been practicing acupuncture for, I guess 26 years now. Mm. And I have a lot of patients that come regularly, so I know them well, and I've known many of them for over 20 years. And I've had two that had coronaries out of that whole group. Now, that whole group is about 8,000 new patients. So the statistics are there if you want to search it out. So acupuncture, chiropractic, what else? What else can we do for the immune system? All the movement disciplines are useful. Number one, I would say, is yoga. Mm-hmm. You know, that was actually a spiritual discipline.
Yeah.
The yogis did that not because they worried about getting sick or preventing heart disease, but because it was a spiritual discipline.
Right.
So what were they actually doing? They were actually mapping out their interior and finding blockages in the chakra system. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, perhaps they would sit in meditation for weeks at a time.
You know, I find it interesting with acupuncture. It would be put under the category of Chinese medicine, right?
Right.
Been around for 5,000 years, right?
Right.
No FDA, right?
No.
And it works. And I can attest to the fact that it works because my wife, 2.5 years ago, had severe shoulder and back pain around the scapula. And she went to an acupuncturist, and the insurance refuses to cover it. So we've had to pay out of pockets $700-$800 for the treatments. It is 2.5 years later. She had, I think, maybe 8 or 10 treatments of acupuncture. Since then, zero pain, zero. It hasn't come back. There have been no twinges, nothing, no medications. And she didn't want to go that route. Now she has an issue with her knee. She's doing the same thing. She's going through acupuncture. Now, I find it fascinating, and of course this would require individuals to do a little research and study on why it is that, for example, it's her left knee. So the acupuncturist was placing, I believe it's the filaments in, I think it was in the right arm, the elbow area. And someone said, well, why wouldn't they put the filaments in the knee? Now, I use, by the way, I use the word filaments because technically that's what they are. They're not needles like most people would think, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. They're solid and they're about the diameter of a human hair.
Yeah. And I've actually producing some other programs, and we've had people who practice acupuncture on the program, other programs, and I would sit here producing, and they put one right in my third eye, you know. And it was actually kind of interesting. I actually started to sort of drift a little, you know, but it was okay. I was fine. But I find it interesting that again, I guess it's just because it's something, for some people, it's new, unknown. It's, I don't know, maybe it's scary because, I mean, I'm not a fan of needles. I do not like going in and having blood work done. The last time they took 6 vials, which took a minute and a half to 2 minutes, leaving the needle in there and I could feel it and so forth. But, you know, I'm getting better at it. But it's one of those things where some people say there's no guarantee. Well, the acupuncturist who treated my wife for the first issue didn't make any guarantees. She let the work speak for itself. And now we tell everybody about her because it works, you know? And I think that I don't know if our institutions, whether it be in medical or insurance, will ever embrace it. But then again, take a look at chiropractic. Mm-hmm. It took decades until it was covered.
Yeah, precisely. And most of it depends on how powerful the lobby is behind the paradigm,
yeah.
And which is a shame.
Yeah.
But I think it will be cover. To give you an example, in Germany, there are 40,000 MDs that are doing acupuncture now.
Wow.
That's an astounding number because Germany is a fairly small country. And I traveled extensively through Australia, and I noticed that there – every town would have at least one acupuncturist and a homeopath, and about every fifth town would have an MD.
Mm.
So over there, it is considered primary care medicine.
Wow.
And here, of course, it's shunted to the side. But there's a good reason for that. What do? We get people off of medication. Who hates that? The pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of pressure. In fact, there was an NIH study done in 1992, I believe, and they recommended that Medicare and all the other government programs cover acupuncture because the studies show that it's very effective and cost effective.
Yeah.
Well, there was 5 congressmen that put a bill forward to have that done, and it's still, all these years later, on the table, and it probably never will get voted on.
Yeah. As far as acupuncture is concerned, my understanding is that it is used to open up the blockages of energy throughout the body, or if you want to say the chi, if you will, or the chakra energy, whatever terminology you want to use. My wife asked a very good question the other night in that regard after having her first treatment for her knee. If the body knows not to block these things, how do these energy pipelines, if you will, or circuits, how do they get blocked?
Great question. It's a 5-letter word, stress.
Oh. Spell stress, folks.
Yeah. So that's the short answer.
Yeah.
However, there's another answer, too. In the Chinese thinking, which is vastly more complicated than Western medicine, us Western doctors that studied acupuncture, I took my training at UCLA. I was absolutely astounded about how complicated the theory is. And but one of the things that came forward in our study was that each one of us is born with one of the main meridians or energy circuits that's low.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so that's called a constitutional factor. And so all our problems, physical, mental, emotional problems, are going to center around that one that's weak when we're born.
Do we know which one that is, or is it different for each person?
Different for each person, okay. Which makes it somewhat challenging. But the two common ones that I see are kidney weakness and liver excess, or sometimes kidney or liver weakness. So if one of those meridians is off at birth, then that will sort of describe what your problems are in life. Mm. And so that's not really stress. But if you add stress into that, you can have profound illness. Mm. So I guess the message is that, you know, all of us have good causative factors for illness. And so we have to attend to those issues at some time in our life.
Is there an age at which you can begin to use acupuncture? I mean, how young can a person be, a child?
Yeah, the youngest I've personally treated is 4 days old.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. You're getting in there right away
right
to deal with one of those two issues. Okay.
Right. That was a woman that brought her child in with who was screaming for 4 days after birth. You know, it was a bad case of colic. And all the parents out there know how awful that is. And it was very easy to treat the infant, but I said, Mom, the problem is you, not the baby. So I treated both of them. Now, she got a treatment with the acupuncture, and the baby, of course, I don't use needles until the kids are probably 10, 11, 12. But we use either tapping with a finger on the acupoints mm-hmm. or on the chakra points or a tuning fork.
Oh, okay.
And the vibration of the tuning fork will also clear the blockages. And so that's the way I did with that baby. And then the oldest that I've worked on so far is 98. And so we literally can work on everyone. But if I were to choose an age where I really like to see folks, it would be in the late 20s. Because the problems have identified, you know, they've been identified. We know what the problems are. And three or four treatments in someone that age, and man, we're going to avoid arthritis and heart disease and all that other stuff if they pay attention to lifestyle issues, you know.
Right.
I can't do magic with the needles, but we can certainly give them a head start.
Exactly. And at that age, things have begun, but they haven't been set in stone yet. They haven't been locked in, per se, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I have to say that at the age of 15, I knew that whatever I put into my body, not just liquids and solids, but even through my eyes and my ears and other senses, was going to affect how I would turn out as I got older and older. And sadly, I was a big soda drinker. I mean, to the point where I had created a cup holder on my bicycle for the large 64-ounce, okay?
Yeah.
And so when I was delivering newspapers or bicycling around, I had that thing right there, and I could take it out and take a swig through the straw and put it back in the cup holder and just continue on down the road thinking, well, I'm exercising while I'm drinking this stuff. But it's not that simple, because it's the stuff that you're ingesting that has the impact. And maybe in one sense, I'm sort of paying the price for that to some degree. Issues of uric acid buildup, which leads to gout and so forth, and potentially even high blood pressure and that type of thing. And it's funny, I never had any problems until I moved here to Santa Barbara. I don't think it was the location. I think that it was just that if I had dealt with these issues in my 20s, as you certainly recommend, then who knows where I'd be today in terms of my health and well-being. And I still consider myself to be very healthy, you know. I still consider myself to be getting around well. I'm able to walk, which to me is huge. On my smartphone, I have a pedometer and sort of a health program, if you will. And so when I walk 5,000 to 10,000 steps in a day, my phone tells me, hey, great job. You're really active today. And when I don't do that, it harasses me and says, you need to be more active today. You need to be more active today, kind of thing. That I can handle. But when it comes to dealing, especially now that I'm past 50, and my goal, of course, is to live to 100. It has to do with my great-grandmother, who was in her 90s, and I used to tell people I would outlive her. And every year that went by and every birthday party that we attended, I said, and she's making it really hard. Mm-hmm. And she passed on after reaching 100. She got one of those letters from the governor celebrating her 100th birthday, which was kind of cool. And I'm hoping that I can do it. I don't know if I will. Who knows? We don't get out of this world alive, which actually leads us into our next subject, which we're going to get into after our break, and that's the fact that you, Dr. Richard House, you died and you lived to tell about it. And we're going to talk about that when we get back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices. I'm Richard Dugan. Joining us here in the studio for our second half of the program is Dr. Richard House. He has a book out that you certainly can pick up at his website, richardhousemd.com. It's Between Now and When, and we encourage you to do that. It has to do with how my death made my life worth living. And I remember talking with a guest who also had a, as it was described, a near-death experience. So I coined the phrase, you died and lived it to tell about it. And that's rather remarkable because at least from what I know, which is more biblical references, it is appointed for every man once to die and then the judgment. But there are people who, and I can't argue with them on this. I wasn't there. I didn't experience it. Only you can address it, and I'm not going to pass judgment on it either way. You say you died. You as an MD know what clinical death is. And is that what we're talking about? Or what is the definition of death? How do we make that determination? Because then I think about Lazarus. Jesus raising Lazarus, quote unquote, from the dead. And it's like, well, wait a minute. But that passage, it is appointed for every man once to die. And later in the book, and Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. Wait a minute. Was Lazarus an exception to the rule? Is Dr. Richard House an exception to the rule? So tell me, what is, from your perspective, both spiritually as well as medically, what is death?
You know, that is not an easy question to answer. But I'd be delighted to try. In a sense, the fact that every one of us dies means that there has to be grand purpose to the scheme. There have been cases of people that have lived for very prolonged periods of time, as of course Methuselah in the Bible is a good example, if you believe that. Is it possible to live 1,000 years? Absolutely. Are there people that do have those extended lifetimes today? I believe so. There's a fairly well-known case in India of a fellow who's over 300. So when we start thinking about those things, we have to leave the idea of linear thinking that we are sort of saddled with in this dimension. Newtonian physics, medical biology says all that is impossible, and yet these things happen. So what is going on? That's the question. Well, we have to get into metaphysics in order to understand why we die and what happens afterwards. And yes, I did have a near-death experience, but that's not how I learned about death. It was certainly an introduction to the subject, and if you like, I'll tell you a little bit about it. And I'm going to start and make this a very short story, but when I was 7 years old, I was standing underneath a tree, and all of a sudden I experienced the incredible sensation of oneness with everything that is. So as you can imagine, as a seven-year-old child, I really didn't have any frame of reference for that experience, but it was so incredible that from that time on, I viewed myself as being something more than just a mere human on this earth. But nothing much occurred after that until I was just, raised in a good family. You'll get a kick out of this. When I had that experience, I tried to find a different name for myself.
Really?
And I've heard that from other people that have experienced this, that you're no longer who you were. And so at the age of 7, I'm struggling. Now, what is my real name? You know, I was born with the name Richard, as you were. The name I came up with was Ichen, of all things, I-C-H-E-N. And I have to, just as a sidebar, I was doing an interview a few weeks ago, and the interviewer said, you know, I read that in your book, and I looked it up. And actually, Icken has a spiritual sort of definition behind it. And I wish I could remember what it was, but it was fascinating. But anyway, so I started calling myself Icken. Well, afterwards, my mom, who is a very strict woman, an academician, my dad a dentist, she bent down and said, "What's this Icken business? Your name is Richard." And that was pretty much the end of that. So the rest of my childhood was pretty normal. But when I was 13, I had the first truly mystical experience other than the oneness. And that in that, I was minding my own business, and all of a sudden there was a message that I received that I knew somehow was divine in origin. And for you listeners, you know, a lot of times we have thoughts and we wonder where they come from. Is this coming from ourself, our subconscious, or is this truly a message from whoever we believe is bigger than us? Well, in my case, the answer was always made clear by the emotion that comes along with the message. Well, the message that I got at the tender age of 13 was that I would die when I was 33. That's an alarming message. But the emotion that was connected with it was one of excitement and joy. You know, it was inexplicable in the sense of that. And so it didn't worry me. And I sort of said, oh, okay, well, so be it. And I didn't try and avoid that death, and I didn't dwell on it. It certainly wasn't a depressing sort of notion. What happened after that? I was a good student. I was admitted to a fine university, Butler University in Indianapolis, which I just visited a few weeks ago. It's a delightful place. But I was down in the gardens there at Butler, and I realized that my life plan was somehow being guided by someone larger than myself. Now, I had decided to be a dentist, but when I was at Butler, I was in a fraternity. And unfortunately, that fraternity was kicked off of campus, and I have a pretty good idea why. But I learned how to drink there. And so my buddy Jack Daniels and I had quite a college career. And so I had about a 2-3 average, and that's definitely not good enough, just barely good enough to get into dental school. But anyway, I was down in the garden, and I had another message from who I presumed to be God, and it said, "You know, you really don't need to be a dentist. You need to be a doctor." And I thought, whoa, how could, you know, with a 2-3 average, a doctor? Are you kidding? And, you know, oddly enough, I believed it. And sure enough, that prophecy came true. And we're going to fast forward here. I go through all these details in my book. But I became a successful surgeon and had the doctor's life, a beautiful wife, a wonderful child, a Porsche in the garage, you know, the whole business. But I also had Jack Daniels as my best friend, and he turned on me, and I ended up getting really sick. I mean sick. I started bleeding from every orifice, pardon my language. And so I was admitted to the hospital and in terminal end-stage liver failure. Now, what that meant was that I was about as yellow as a banana, and the bleeding simply wouldn't stop. After 18 transfusions of blood that was donated by my friends and family, the doctor came in and said, I'm sorry, my friend, this is hopeless. Since I knew the diagnosis and so on, I agreed with him. And everyone out there that's listening that has had a battle with alcoholism will know exactly what I'm saying when I say that it is a life filled with suffering. It is absolutely awful to be in the clutches of addiction to that level.
I have to say that I have a real hard time drinking, period. I mean, I do. I have a beer occasionally, some, you know, mixed drinks, this and that, and the other, wine, what have you. But that... scares me. Not because I've ever had a problem with it, mind you, but because of what you've just described in your life, I don't like losing control in that fashion. And maybe it's part of the fact that I'm a control freak. But I just don't want to go down that road. And so I really monitor my consumption, you know. So in a manner of speaking, I've kind of learned, in spite of the fact that, you know, in spite of the fact that parents will say, I want you to learn from my mistakes. Well, we can't really do that. But in this case, I'm kind of doing that because I've seen people who, yes, they've bounced back, such as yourself. You've come back from that. I mean, you had to go through that in order to be where you are today. That may be true. But then by the same token, do you think that if you hadn't gone through that, you would be doing the things that you're doing now? Did you need to go through that process?
I think so. Not that I recommend it.
Right, exactly, exactly.
No, we all eventually, you see, I believe that our spiritual quest, our spiritual journey takes place over more than one lifetime. And as a result, eventually, we, all of us, will come up against some impossible situation in our lives, something that we simply cannot deal with. And it brings us to our knees. And it may be addiction, or it may be extreme illness, or whatever. But there comes a time when we simply say, I give up. And so in my case, it was addiction. And so when the guy came in and he said, we're going to turn off the blood, I said, man, that sounds good. I'm sick of this. You know, I was filled with remorse and guilt and physical suffering.
Yeah.
And but what happened that night after they stopped all that, I'd said my goodbyes to my family, and of course they believed I was going to die too. It took one look at me, and man, here, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this. I was 33.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of suspected. I kind of suspected.
Yeah. So anyway, about 2 in the morning, I experienced this onset of this incredible feeling that can be called comfort. It was the first time since I was 7 years old that I was really comfortable on this earth. And the feeling was so marvelous. But it continued to build. And then pretty soon I started feeling what can only be called bliss, which is sort of the opposite of suffering plus, plus, plus. You know, it was just a wonderful euphoric state. And I felt like I was swimming in this ocean of love. Now, I think most people that have experienced a near-death experience or had a near-death experience will say pretty much the same thing. And so I want to generalize that for a moment for listeners out there. It is my firm belief that every death begins this way, that as soon as the physical connection between the soul and the body weakens, we start to feel these things. Whether it's the death of a 98-year-old that's lived a fine life and is just dying of natural causes in their sleep, or a horrific accident, even a traumatic death, as soon as the consciousness separates from the physical body, we start swimming in this ocean of love.
Mm. I've heard it said, especially with traumatic deaths, that the soul, if you will, the essence of who we are, leaves just before, shall I say, the impact. In other words, it knows it's not safe to stay in that physical body, even though the body is not, is still functioning, okay? In other words, it's like if a person were falling or say the person were being shot in a fatal manner, that the instant before that, they check out of that body physically. Now, the only best example of that I can give is many years ago with my first wife, we were walking. She was totally blind, and she had a guide dog, a black Labrador named Yora. And we were taking a walk through the neighborhood, and we were walking by this one house. And from around the corner of the house came running 2 pit bulls. One of them grabbed her around the throat. And by the way, she did survive. And then the other one grabbed her on the shoulder. She just sat down and didn't make a sound, didn't fight, I was the one fighting to get these dogs off. But she just sat down and just, so to speak, took it. And I feel that she left saying, "It's not safe here." And then when we took her to the vet and they got her all patched up, when she came home, it was as if it had never happened. She was that puppy. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. It goes back to that business of linear thinking versus the higher dimensional thinking, which is circular.
Mm-hmm.
In the East, in some traditions, they say that we're not only born with a birth date, but we're also born with a death date. And, you know, if you can wrap your mind around that.
So in other words, we come into this world, or before we come into this world, we have a round-trip ticket.
Exactly.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah. But as my father would say, as part of one of his great sayings, nobody gets out of this world alive.
Mm-hmm.
Even this 300-year-old guy you're talking about in India, maybe one day he's going to
depart. Definitely will.
Yeah.
Why? Well, we'll leave that other subject for a moment, but and say why? What happens? It's because Ram Dass was famous for saying this. This is our curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we learn. This is where we experience life. And we learn from our mistakes, and we glory when we get it right.
Mm.
And so, you know, if you're born a male and you are comfortable in that male body, you will be a male no matter what. But that's your general outline for experience. And you know, if you're born in Phoenix, that's a general outline for your experience. And so what if you have some underlying blueprints for more experience, like being a female and living in Nova Scotia? Well, how do we do that? We can't do all those things in one lifetime. So what happens is that we drop our bodies. Does that mean that our identity goes away? No, it doesn't. The death process, we remain conscious through the whole thing. But next time we're born into Nova Scotia as a female. And so, and in that lifetime, we will also learn a new curriculum. Now, the basic curriculum, I think, is transcending the non-virtues and developing virtues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is what every religious tradition and spiritual tradition teaches. That we learn not to hate, and we learn to love. We learn to be generous instead of selfish, and so on and so forth. There are seven of those deadly sins, so to speak, that I call non-virtues. Well, it is my belief that the non-virtues are the pathways to virtuous life. So we don't ever get rid of jealousy and anger and selfishness. But what we do is we learn to transcend them and sort of cover them up with all the good works that we learn to do eventually. Mm-hmm. So that's why we die.
You know, two images came to mind. Number one is this aspect of other lives that we live, as mm-hmm. your description of a male and female. And I ask the question of people who are questioning the validity, if you will, and I still kind of question it myself, of reincarnation. I say, okay, let me ask you, when did you first start driving? And most people, it was 16, thereabouts. And what was your first car? And in a general sense, what was the purpose of that car, of having that car? It wasn't necessarily cruising and picking up girls. It was getting from point A to point B. Now, if, like you and I, we're in our 50s, 60s, 70s, whatever, what have you, we've had, who knows, 3, 4, 5, 10 cars, okay? And they were all designed to get us from point A to point B. Well, it's been described to me that it's the same thing with our lives, that we just, it's still us, but we just change vehicles. We leave this one and we take on another one and we carry on and we carry on the curriculum, if you will. School is not quite over yet. You've only been through the fifth grade and you've got to go to 12 or 15 or whatever it is, PhD, master's, what have you. And I think that in spite of the fact that I used to argue that the only way that I could really logically accept reincarnation is if a baby were born with a rock that could be carbon dated from, I don't know, maybe the 5th century or the 10th century or something of this nature. Bring me some evidence. I mean, real evidence. But then it really occurred to me that as we come into this world, and you talk about the issues that we're born with when we come into this world, when the adults see that infant, that newborn, they will make various comments to say, oh, well, has Aunt Mary's nose and has Uncle Bill's giggle and has John's this or Mary's that, or, you know, and so forth, talking about all these different attributes. And as the child grows and begins showing their personality and their temperament, oh, he's got Frederick's anger or, you know, and so on and so forth. So I got to theorizing that we are a compilation of our ancestors. And in one sense, that is a pseudo form, I'll say, of reincarnation. That we are a compilation of our ancestors and their physical, mental, emotional, and I have to wonder, even spiritual attributes? Can you talk to that?
Sure, yeah. It's almost like a tribe. You see, it's my feeling that each one of us is a member of a tribe that has about 1,000 members. And so the physicality, as you describe, therefore is within that tribe of maybe 1,000 souls. And so those physical bodies that are created by parents, you know, through the DNA matchup, also are aligned with our needs for another lifetime. So when we are in between births, then our blueprints are matched up with the physicality, the ancestors, as you're talking about, so that we can experience what we need to experience in that lifetime. And a lot of people that report their experiences with reincarnation will say, you know, in fact, there are a lot of books written about this. Mm-hmm. You know, that that mom was a lover in another lifetime. Or I've had a lot of people tell me that they were a farmer in a different – I remember one lady said she was a farmer in Russia and had canvas pants on. And, you know, those kinds of very explicit memories. And then there are people that have traveled to places where they recognize that they haven't been this lifetime. So there's a lot of that evidence out there, really. But let's look at the reason for that. Now, if you buy reincarnation, and I don't, you know, the beautiful part about reincarnation is you don't have to believe in it to participate in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. So, but if you have that viewpoint, if you can accept the fact that we're both, all of us, experience what it is to be a male, female, rich, poor, sick, healthy, live in Russia, and live in the United States, and we've probably all lived in China and India at some point. You know, it gives you a different world view.
Yeah.
Because, you know, otherwise, when you think about, well, how does this work about God? You know, it's clear that some of us are born with everything. You know, and probably live in Santa Barbara too, but and then other people are born in Sudan, and starve to death by the time they're 5. How does that work? Well, without having reincarnation as a premise, then it makes God either capricious, or distant, or maybe not even around at all.
Yeah.
But if you see that this is all part of a grand scheme, where we all are at some point starving in Sudan, and we all have an experience of wealth and power, then we become a community of souls instead of each fighting each other like we're so fond of doing.
Yeah, yeah, no, I hear you. It's interesting to to look at this process, reincarnation connected, of course, with the process that human beings go through called death. And I have to say that in spite of current events, I don't know if I'm being naive or from my perspective, just being realistic, I don't have the fears that others do, that I see and hear about on television and on the radio and in the newspapers and sometimes in conversations. My perspective is, as you've described it and as I reiterated it, I came into this world with a round-trip ticket. I don't know what the return flight time is, and it doesn't really matter, because when my flight is called, I go. There's nothing I can do about that. When my time is up, I'm done. And how I go doesn't really matter. You know, I mean, this was an interesting question that was raised, asking, are there statistics that show the percentage of people who die quiet and peaceful lives where they just lay down and they die, or they die in their sleep, this kind of thing, as opposed to violent deaths? Now, I don't know what the statistics are. If it's 50-50, half the population dies in their sleep and half the population dies a violent death. You know, and what difference would that make, even if we knew? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's some questions that I remember the statement made to me about my questioning things. It says, leave some questions for, you know, the afterlife. But then there are some questions that it doesn't matter what the answer is. I mean, how would that change your life if you knew the answer to that question?
It might make it more fearsome.
Really, in one sense,
who wants to know when you're going to die?
Yeah.
Because you want to live life to its fullest and not say, it's sort of like when you're watching a movie in a theater and you see that it's going to end and it's been a really nice movie, you say, wow, I wish it kept going.
Yeah.
So I don't want to know when I'm going to die. What I do want to know is that I've made the most of the life that I'm living today.
Yeah.
But the other thing I want to reiterate is that the death experience is so wonderful. There's a lot of metaphysics that goes beyond what I've explained already, but the death experience is incredibly blissful. So it's not anything to be feared. Of course, we're going to do it anyway, because if we didn't fear death, then we wouldn't be careful. And
we would take maybe unnecessary risks.
Yeah, and there are a lot of folks that do that anyway, I know. But if you want to live to be 80, you don't do base jumping, you know. You just don't.
Well, then you need to talk with George Herbert Walker Bush. He's still jumping out of airplanes at his age. So I don't know what's going on there. And more power to him if he feels that, you know, he can do that. That's wonderful. I mean, you know, if you have the wherewithal to take on those kinds of things. I used to bicycle everywhere in Phoenix, and people thought I was crazy. I would feel that I was crazy if I tried bicycling here in Santa Barbara. And it's a small town, but the roads are narrower. People are not as observant for whatever reason. And yet every once in a while, I will get out on the bicycle and traverse the roads. But I kind of plan it out in my head. I know where the bike path roads are, the roads with the bike paths, two lanes, and so on and so forth. I've always been a defensive driver, and I've never counted on anybody to do the right thing. I love my mother dearly, but it's not her responsibility. And I take that same tack with my life. It's nobody else's responsibility. I may get frustrated because I got to take this medication and I got to go do that procedure and what have you as far as my health is concerned. And it's like, I thought I did a good job taking care of myself, you know. And now I'm dealing with all of these issues. And the only thing that I can tell myself is, this is just a phase. In other words, this isn't going to last for the next 45 years. I honestly don't believe that it will, that I'm going to find that equanimity, if you will, in my life that calms things down where, in this case, for example, my blood pressure, it's now down to normal and I'm not taking meds.
Good for you.
Now, I might be taking an herb or something of that nature, but I'm fine with that because From my perspective, there's a big difference between that and taking a pharmaceutical. I don't know about you, but I get a kick out of these commercials for some of the pharmaceuticals, and then they run the disclaimer about the side effects. Mm. And I was watching one where this was for it was a heart medication. I forget what the condition was, but one of the side effects was the very condition for which you were taking the medication. I'm going, wait a minute. That's like with the high blood pressure meds. Most of them, one of the side effects is rapid weight gain. It's like, well, but weight gain exacerbates high blood pressure because you're carrying around more weight and your heart is having trouble pumping the blood through that heavier system. But, you know, my wife she's calmer about my blood pressure. which is all over the place, by the way. And that's another thing, too, is what is normal? You know, what is normal? I mean, they've set these parameters, 120 over 80. That's normal. And anything above or below it, and you need to be concerned, whether it's 5 or 50 points, either way, right? Who's to say that my normal blood pressure isn't 145 over 90?
No one. No one can tell you because our Western medicine is based on generalities. But when you go to an acupuncturist and he or she takes your pulses, mm-hmm. it all of a sudden isn't generalized anymore. It's you. And so we're dealing with a personal individual health when you see an energetic healer of any kind. And that's why in other countries it has superseded Western medicine. And so, yeah, who sets the norm for high blood pressure? I can answer that. It's the drug companies.
Ah.
Yeah, sure. So much of the medical research now is done not by universities like it used to be, but through the drug industries that are sweethearts of the FDA, by the way.
By the way, is there an acupuncture, procedure, if you will, or what have you, for example, high blood pressure?
Tough answer. I'm going to say yes and no.
Okay.
Because sometimes the high blood pressure is normative.
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right. And those of us that understand that wouldn't want to change a blood pressure that's normative, even if it's 150 over 90.
Yeah.
So we'd want to leave that alone. Well, fortunately, with acupuncture, we don't make those decisions consciously.
Right.
Because the body will make it for us. So we take pulses. We find out that the kidney meridian is low and that the liver meridian is excessive. So we balance those two out and say, all right, body, what are you going to do?
Mm. You're describing a process that I learned about many years ago, called kinesiology.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the woman who taught me the process. It was a very simple thing where you take your thumb and your index finger and you make a ring, and then you take your other hand and your thumb and your index finger and you make a chain, two chains, and then you basically say yes and no. And then you go and ask the question that you're asking because your body will tell you. Your body knows. And that's kind of what you're describing in that sense, is that the body knows what's good for it. Now, I would say that if I went out and decided I was going to have a big gulp out of the 7-Eleven this afternoon, I don't think that that's my body telling me that that's good for me. That's the craving, the sugar and or the – and I like the fizz. So I switched to seltzer water. I've tried mineral water and so on and so forth. I even switched to chai tea, which wasn't a good thing because I liked it so much that I drank more. And it, of course, has some sugar in it, so I started to put on a little bit of the weight, a pound at a time. But I think that we each have to find that equilibrium of ours. And I think we listen to the outside world more than the inside, or you know, the heart, not so much the mind, as far as guiding us to our optimal health, don't we?
Absolutely. And one of the ways to do it is to develop some sort of discipline. You've talked about cravings, and mm-hmm. it's one of the biggest issues there is out there. And it may be for alcohol, it may be for sugar, or for any other substance, salt. I went through a phase where I craved almost anything that I ate, and I couldn't stop eating it. You know, and so, and a lot of people tell me that they never would buy a bag of potato chips. They know they'd eat the whole damn thing, you know. So what about these cravings? How do we address that? There certainly isn't any drug or surgery that's going to stop craving. But if we develop discipline, then it helps us deal with the cravings. And so the disciplines take the form of some kind of daily practice, which most of the time is something we don't want to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, who wants to get up at 5 a.m. and go to the gym, you know? Who wants to go to a yoga class every Saturday instead of playing golf or whatever?
Yeah.
But if you incorporate those things into your life, then you can deal with the cravings that come up. And so pretty soon you look at that big gulp and say, hey, that's not food.
Yeah. I think two things. My father said, this was also part of that other phrase. He says, eat, drink, and be merry in moderation. Mm-hmm. That was his proviso, in moderation. So whenever I have those cravings, I do have something around the house that I can, say, take a small square of chocolate, and that's all I need. And I'm fine. I don't need to sit there and eat the whole candy bar or, you know, whatever the craving might be. If I can just get a little taste, I'm good to go, you know. And that's a far cry from, of course, the way it used to be, where I'd go. I mean, I was literally drinking 32-ounce bottles of soft drink. Wow. Sometimes one or two a day. Then I was able to cut it down to you know, a can of or a bottle of, a small, you know, 8 or 12-ounce bottle. And then I was able to get it down to, what was it, you know, one every couple of 3 days. And a matter of fact, I've lost count after 12 or 13 weeks, and it was back in, I think, late August that I stopped. If I were to be 100% honest, I would say that the only soft drink that I have had was a Sprite that I had to settle my stomach during my food poisoning bout. But other than that, no. And we're like 15 or 16 or 17 weeks or what have you, you know. And as I say, I've lost count. And I guess it really doesn't matter, because I've realized that when I take a look at the soda aisle in the grocery store, or I'm walking down the street and I see the restaurant or the fast food place with the soda in the window, and I think, okay, and do you remember how much pain you had in your ankle or your foot or your knee because of the uric acid in particularly that you exacerbated from that sugar? Is that what you want? Because you love walking. You love being out there. So I'm doing that mental talk. And I think that we all have to do that. And it sounds to me like you've come to that place in your life where it's now just, for you, it's what, second nature? Or do you still fight some of those cravings?
Here's an interesting thing. I have noticed that not only with myself, but with many of the folks that I see in the office, the cravings are getting worse.
Oh, wow.
And I think there is, you know, it's a whole nother topic about why. But
is something in the air, something in the water,
yes.
Conspiracy, aliens.
It is a polarization. We're reaching the end days. And so everything is polar.
Yeah.
And
extremes.
Yeah, extremes. And so to answer your question, I have to pay more attention to my disciplines now than I used to. Mm. You know, I get up real early in the morning at 3:30 and do my first meditation. And then do the yoga and do the gym and do the walk every day and all these disciplines. Why? So that I can walk away from the things that I crave. And so that's the answer. That if the stronger your cravings, the more you need to have a discipline in another area. So you're getting by with no soft drinks makes it easier to get just one square of chocolate and be satisfied.
Yeah.
So each discipline helps you with the cravings that seem to be multiplying these days.
Yeah. You know, it's and then there's the other side of the other extreme, if you will, of wanting to eat healthfully and having the struggles with not knowing what to eat that's okay for me. Let's just say I've figured out how to avoid, say, GMO foods. All right, so I've done that. And it's a good idea to stay away from dairy because human beings don't need dairy. That's for the calves, for example. And then you don't want to eat a lot of animal products because of the way that they were slaughtered, the way that they were raised and then slaughtered in fear. And now you're eating that fear and so on and so forth. So I'm starting to run out of things that I can consume to keep my body going. And then there's that other question that I would often ask of my guests. You know that science has proven that everything is energy, right?
Right.
So then what difference does it make what we consume if it's all just energy?
Oh, that last one is an unanswerable question.
But, I mean, that's the paradox that we live in right now. And, again, that goes to your comment about extremes. We have an abundance of food, but is that food really good for our bodies? And if you start looking at where your food comes from and how it is raised. And I remember reading about, and this was in a book that I consider my metaphysical primer, Autobiography of a Yogi. Mm-hmm. I was introduced to Jagadish Chandra Bose, and he created the Cresco graph, which measured the turgor pressure in plants. And he did experiments where he subjected the plants hooked up to the Cresco graph, just as the gentleman in Japan did with the water crystals, to various emotional mm-hmm. stimuli mm-hmm. and watched the responses. So now, in addition to I can't eat animals because they're beings too, they have life. Well, now the Cresco graph shows that so do plants.
Yeah.
So now what do we do? Now we're really stuck. So again, it's okay. How far do we go with these things? And so it goes back to, I think, what you were talking about, listening to our bodies.
Yes. And I think the simple answer to the questions are that if you look around the world and see who does the best with avoiding heart disease, cancer, and so on and so forth, it's always in Asia. You know, their incidence of cancer is so far less than ours. In fact, I had this patient that moved here from Vietnam, and she said, I don't understand about all this breast cancer here. She said, in Vietnam, it's almost non-existent.
Mm.
So what is happening? And you've zeroed in on it. It's sugar and animal protein are the two things that distinguish us from Asia. And so I don't think there's a whole lot of controversy now, and I preach this, but hardly anyone will listen, and that is the best diet is to avoid those things that you're talking about, mm-hmm. the sugar, dairy, wheat for most people, and animal protein. Now, does that mean that you should be a vegetarian and you can't eat anything except rice and vegetables?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not necessarily. You know, even if you cut down to half of your meals meatless and eliminating those other things, you're going to live a very healthy life.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm not a big meat eater. I mean, I will, and I love, for example, I was introduced to ahi tuna here in Santa Barbara mm-hmm. when we first moved here, and I love it. It's not even the flavor. It's more the texture. It just feels good in my mouth. It's wonderful when it's done right. And my wife has cooked it for me on a number of occasions. She is not a fish eater, seafood eater, but she will make it for me. And I love it. Chicken, I love chicken. Even when we had chickens that were laying eggs that we would consume, we didn't eat the chickens. I would never tell them that we were having chicken. But I find it interesting that our Western lifestyle – and that we seem to want to spread around the world. I look at that and I go, oh, why don't you just send Ebola, okay? All right? Or the plague. Why don't you just because what we have to give to the rest of the world when it comes to nutrition specifically, we shouldn't be doing. We should not be allowed. And in Europe, for example, they don't allow GMO, anything.
That's right.
They've banned it. And, you know, Monsanto can do whatever they want. You can't export it to Europe. And the other aspect of it, too, is that, you know, what are these people going to eat once they've destroyed the food system, you know, with this process? But I don't think that's going to happen. I think there are a lot of people who have their own gardens. I love the farmers markets that we have here in Santa Barbara. throughout the week. I mean, you have a different one every day in different locations here in Santa Barbara. And you can get fresh, organic. And I used to question that. Well, what is organic, you know? Our chickens, we fed all natural feed. It wasn't organic. And but I don't know if it had GMO corn in it or whatever, you know. But again, I always keep going back to that thing about it's all energy.
Yeah.
You know, and trying to justify it, you know. I want to thank you so much for sharing this this time with us. And before we let you go, I want to remind our listeners, Between Now and When is the title of the book, Dr. Richard House. It's richardhousemd.com, Richard House, H-O-U-S-E. That's richardhouse.com, md.com. Make sure to get the MD in there. And check out his website. We are linked to him. Before I let you go, and again, I thank you so much for, I know you didn't come all this way just to be on the program, but I'd like to think so. That's pretty nice. One day we'll be doing that. Or I'll be going to your location and interviewing you in your home and area. Who is Richard House?
Is that a question?
That is a question.
All energy.
Okay. All right.
Let me answer that just real quickly. You know, all the things that I've gone through have brought me to my knees, and then I've been lifted up. And so I consider myself a healer and a teacher. So that's what I would say. And I think I'm about as surrendered as anyone that you've ever met.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve with the work that you are doing now?
Well, I firmly believe that we're on the brink of a new consciousness. And I'm certainly not the only one that believes that. The reason I've entitled my book, Between Now and When, is that now represents this old era that in the East is called the Age of Kali, K-A-L-I. Or in Western terms, the Age of Pisces. Mm-hmm. And I think we're close to entering into the Age of Aquarius. Of course, that was, remember the rock musical?
Oh, yeah.
Hair,
Jesus Christ
sure.
Superstar. Yeah,
both of them. Yeah. and so this new age requires, it's an overlap. We have the old age and we have the new age. And so there are a lot of us, people like me and people like you, that are thinking about these issues. And we're sort of leading the way into the new age thinking. And so as time goes on, we will see this sort of grow in everyone out there can participate in this. And, of course, my message to folks would be to accept what you have in your life with some gratitude and to see it as your curriculum, whether it's good, bad, or in between, because there isn't anyone that escapes the suffering in this world. That's what Buddha said, and I think sometimes we don't see it as suffering if we have the right outlook. Mm. And so we can spread that outlook. We can spread the good words, and we can help people with their own issues so that the new age comes as quickly as possible.
I remember working for the Christian radio station and hearing the message of the end times and all of this stuff, and it was just going on and on. And so I asked the question, is there anything I can do to help facilitate the bringing about of this Armageddon and end of the world kind of thing so we can get on with it? Because, you know, it's like you've been going on and about this for 2,000 years, and that's 2,000 years too many. Let's just get on with it, you know, and that's kind of how I feel about this. Let's just get on with the new ways of living, the new ways of even communicating for that matter and move forward. It's like, okay, enough already. And I've only been here 55 years. My dad, for example, he's been here for 84. So you'd think he'd be more tired of the whole process of this little game than I would be. You know? But what are you going to do? And finally, before we wrap up here, what is your life's purpose?
You know, I take it more a day at a time. Maybe I ought to sit down and define it and have a mission statement. But what I'm really trying to do, I'm not trying to sell books. I'll have to tell you that. I'm delighted when people by the book, but I'm trying to open people's thinking beyond the linear. So, you know, we've talked about a lot of different issues today. And what I want people to understand is that there really is a rational system. It seems like everything is chaotic in our experience on life and that it's a fearful, dangerous place to be. But it's my view that it's all carefully choreographed and that if we pay attention to the things that we've talked about here today, that our lives can be not only fulfilled, but we can spread that among the people that we love. And that if we have love in our hearts, that it's contagious. And so my purpose, as I would say it, is to spread that message, that we need to do the best we can, that each one of us has a vote in when this new consciousness comes.
Yeah. Well, I'll be working on my end of it to bring it about, and I'm looking forward to sharing that experience with you and others. And again, thank you for sharing this experience with us.
My pleasure, Richard.
This was great fun. I'm Richard Dugan, and we've been talking with Richard House, MD. That's the website, richardhousemd.com. Between Now and When is the title of the book, and it has to do with his, not just with his near-death experience, but how my death made my life worth living. And I am looking forward to coming back again with another program next week. So until then, this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Until next week, love to Lal.